And now the final push is on. President Bush is out on the campaign trail, but only in states he won 2 years ago. The goal, to rally Republicans and the base in particular in light of dispiriting polls and avoid swing states such as Ohio and Pennsylvania, where the president's presence could hurt Republicans. Today he spoke to a cheering crowd in Springfield, Missouri.
We cut the taxes on every American who pays income taxes. We doubled the child tax credit. We reduced taxes on small businesses. We reduced the tax on the marriage penalty. We cut taxes on capital gains and dividends, and to reward family businesses and farmers here in the state of Missouri, we put the death tax on the road to extinction.
The president will also hold rallies in smaller towns, Joplin, Missouri, and Lamars, Iowa, and our next two guests will be there. What do they want to hear the president say? Joining us from Iowa is Leanne Hadding, who works in the office of Galen Catholic School in Lamars, Iowa. Leanne, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Iola French. She's a local Republican committee woman in Joplin, Missouri, and she's helping get out the vote for the GOP in her area. Iola, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, Leanne, in Iowa. I don't want to describe you. You describe yourself. I mean, you did tell us that you don't see yourself as a Democrat or a Republican. So how do you view yourself?
I view myself, I guess I look more at what the candidates are for. I just really feel like it's very important that the candidates are for the issues. And I really do not like the negative campaigning. I am not a real political type person, but there just are some issues that are very important to my heart.
What are those?
And I truly believe that every child should be able to have the option to go to whatever school they want, whether it's public or private.
So you're for the voucher system that the president is for?
For the voucher system, and also on a state-local level, we have a Monsignor Lafferty tuition tax credit that could benefit the students across Iowa tremendously and allow them to go to whatever school they want.
Well, now, would you describe yourself as conservative and a supporter of President Bush? You did get a coveted ticket to go to a rally. So.
Oh, yeah, we're excited. You don't get very many chances to see the president.
And what do you want to hear?
What do we want to hear? We want to hear that, you know, that the president is supportive of everyone. We want to hear that he is supportive of our troops and at the same time working to get our troops home. We want to hear what he has to say about stem cell research, adult stem cell research, not fetal stem cell research.
Well, let me stop you right there, Leanne, because I know that stem cell research is important to you as well, Iola, there in Missouri. Leanne mentioned adult stem cells, quite different from embryonic stem cells. There's a constitutional amendment on the Missouri ballot to allow research on embryonic stem cells. Supporters say they're more effective and they only use embryos that are going to be discarded anyway. People who are against embryonic stem cells say that it still destroys embryos, which they perceive as life, and adult stem cells are as effective. Your thoughts?
I believe, like Leanne, that adult stem cell research has some real promise. Embryonic stem cell research has some real issues. I'm not against stem cell research, but I am against this amendment. There's another reason I'm against this amendment.
What's that?
The reason that I'm against this amendment is that there's a lot of money being poured into our state to push for the amendment, and the reason is that it's our tax dollars are to fund large research companies. Our economy is growing in Missouri, but we need our tax dollars here, and that should be done through the legislatures. The stem cell issue probably will bring out a lot of people to the polls that would not have come out otherwise.
Pro or con?
Probably both ways, but I live in the very southwest corner of Missouri, and Missouri, as you probably know, has been called a bellwether state.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we reflect basically the values of the nation. We're pretty well red, and most of the country is, except for a few blue dots, and then your corner in California.
But how would you? But how would you feel if you went? If you went blue?
We're not going blue. I'm sorry, we're not going blue.
But I'm wondering, to both of you, what are some of the other issues? Because you're talking about stem cells and school vouchers, but the polls say that people are thinking about the war in Iraq. Leanne Hadding there in Iowa,
mm-hmm.
How much is the war in Iraq impacting you?
We just had a big homecoming for our troops here in Lamar's. That's about a week ago. It was pretty emotional and pretty awesome. People are worried about Iraq. They want our troops to be welcomed home. They want us to support our troops, and at the same time, we want our troops home. I don't feel like I'm seeing it go anywhere, and I'm afraid that I don't see that end, and we need to see that, and I need to see the president work towards this end. I don't know if I feel that happening in him. I think there is a lack of trust, in the president and maybe the government at this time. And I just, as some of that comes from, you know, when the times are high, life is good, and everybody's excited. And when something isn't going quite right, the moods are down and everything's bad and everybody starts getting negative. I just think we all just need to be supportive. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, President Bush is in charge at the moment, and we need to support him. We need to trust in what he's going to do, and what he's not doing, we have to be willing to fight to get to change.
And what are some of the things that you, as an ardent supporter of the president, are disappointed in?
Different things like raising the minimum wage. You know, we need to help everyone. We need to change the gap between the poor and the rich. You know, so often you do hear the stories about we're becoming that country of the really poor and the really wealthy.
Well, I want to turn back to Iola French there in Missouri and a Republican committee woman. The things we've been talking about, the concern that perhaps President Bush won't be able to stay the course in Iraq with the rising negativity, does that make it harder for you to rally the vote? I mean, what kinds of discussions are you having with Republicans? Do you come across people who are feeling a lack of trust, who are feeling just in a
That we
bad
want to
mood.
Get out of Iraq?
No. Just saying, I'm just in a bad mood this election season. I'm not even going to go.
Why would we be in a bad mood? The economy is growing at the fastest rate it's ever grown. The stock market is at an all-time high. Unemployment is at an all-time low. As far as the minimum wage thing, I don't know about everywhere else in the country, but there are very few people in our area who make minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Iola French, a Republican committee woman in Joplin, Missouri. Iola, I just know you're planning to go to this rally today in Joplin. Well, what's the president like in person? What's he like to see in a rally like this?
Oh, he's, what would the word be, exuberating? Is that a word?
Exuberating.
I think that our base here is motivated. I think there's some misconception about how motivated the base is because, yes, we don't agree on everything. We shouldn't.
People, if everybody agreed on everything. You wouldn't have to vote.
But we agree on the things that are important, and we are motivated.
As I said, that's Iola French, a Republican committee woman from Joplin, Missouri, and we were also speaking there with Leanne Hadding. She works in a Catholic school in Lamar's, Iowa. Both will go to see the president today. Well, for his perspective, we turn now to Stephen Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University, also known as Dr. Politics, on WOI Public Radio. Stephen, welcome as always.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we were just listening to our two guests saying that negative campaigning is an issue, stem cell research, the minimum wage. But one who is a supporter of the president, wants to support him, that's Leanne Hadding, concerned he may not get the troops home in time, that he may not have endgame in Iraq. The other, Iola, saying, you know, why should we be in a bad mood, even though polls show Republicans in her home state, Missouri, I think it's a 37% approval rating of the president. So is there a little disconnect there?
Well, what's interesting is that the national polls are very dangerous for us to use because they represent a kind of aggregate across the country. They represent a sample of voters that includes Democrats and people in districts and in blue states, and so it gives you a number that may not represent the polling in specific congressional districts or specific states, and that's where elections are won. So we're always, I think, having to say, well, you know, his overall approval ratings are not very good. What are the approval ratings in states where people have to win races? And they're not very good there either. but I think what you heard from the two guests you had was one set of perspectives. And if you picked two people in a different part of the country in different districts, you might have heard something else. You might have heard more concern, for example, about Iraq as the number one issue, less interest in stem cell research.
Well, but we are talking about Missouri and at least the case of Viola French, and we know that what's happening in Missouri seems to be that the amendment there is bringing out conservatives who may not have gone to the polls because of disappointment in their party over issues like Iraq, but it's being said that they may come out to vote against allowing stem cell research.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that you never know what you're going to set on fire when you launch initiatives or when you take actions that you feel are positive and you feel are constructive, but you don't know how that will affect those people who react the opposite. And the issue of abortions, you know, the stem cell discussion is basically a discussion about abortions, isn't it? Because it's basically the question of fetuses, and I know that usually the laws are written so that fetuses are not deliberately aborted to harvest stem cells, but it still comes down to that.
And that is a very
polarizing issue still.
Well, but I want to ask you, the president is primarily campaigning before his hardcore base in this run-up to Election Day. Why is that? Why does the president and the vice president, why do they both feel they have to rally the base?
That's a wonderful question. And the answer is the same. Why did John Kerry campaign in districts to mobilize the base of the Democratic Party until he made a bad joke and had to, you know, retire from campaigning? And the reason is the same. The reason is, in this race, the formula is get out every single one of your core supporters, Democrats in the case of the Democrats, and of course Bush trying to get Republican core voters and conservatives out to vote, because these are going to be very close races, and many of them are going to be cliffhangers. And so what you're trying to do is that last minute rush of adrenaline, get people to say, well, I don't agree with lots of your policies, but on the whole, I would prefer to have my Republican senator or congressperson or whatever than the other guy, or for Democrats, you know, the Democrat.
And, Stephan, in just the minute that we have, Viola French there in Missouri would just seem to, you know, be wholeheartedly in favor of whatever the president asks her to do. Leon Hadding had some concerns. Just briefly, besides the war in Iraq, what else, what are the reasons that the formerly solid base might stay home?
Well, they're very concerned about Bush abandoning some of the other conservative causes, which, you know, that had been promised. The apparent criticism of Christian conservatives that took place in the White House as well.
Well, and in fact, that reminds us of the Mark Foley scandal and the today's scandal revolving an evangelical leader. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. Stephan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University, also known as Dr. Politics on WOI Public Radio. Thanks so much, as always, for speaking with us.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And again, just ahead, the leading evangelical minister who spoke regularly with the president, who stepped down after allegations of involvement with a male prostitute. How might that story impact Election Day? More coming up here now. It's Here and Now.
We've decided the Bible is the Word of God. We don't have to have a General Assembly about what we believe. It's written in the Bible. All right? So we don't have to debate about what we should think about homosexual activity. It's written in the Bible.
The voice in that clip from the 2006 documentary Jesus Camp belongs to Pastor Ted Haggard, one of the nation's most influential conservative Christian leaders, a man who has the president's ear. Haggard resigned yesterday as president of the National Association of Evangelicals after a self-described former male escort accused Haggard of paying for sex over a period of 3 years. Haggard, who denies the allegations, stepped aside temporarily as head of his Colorado megachurch, the New Life Church, while the church investigates the claim. Journalist Jeff Charlotte profiled Haggard in Harper's Magazine last year. Charlotte says he spoke to Haggard's accuser, Mike Jones, yesterday.
Mike Jones was a guy who seemed very sincere, did not seem to be pursuing political gain, but also a guy who's had a lot of hard luck in his life. A guy who I think took big personal and emotional risk in coming forward. You could hear the guy was emotionally upset by doing this. Now, I don't know what all the facts are. I don't know what transpired between Mike and Ted Haggard, but you did not get the sense by any means of a political activist grinding an axe.
Mike Jones has told other outlets that he came forward with his information because he felt that Reverend Haggard was being hypocritical in this election season. As we said, Haggard is denying Jones' allegations, but the interim pastor at the New Life Church says there have been indiscretions. The interim pastor spoke with David Nancaro, a reporter and weekend anchor for KKTV in Colorado Springs. David, what did he say to you?
The interim pastor is a gentleman by the name of Ross Parsley, and he had just spoken to me coming out of a meeting with an independent panel who was doing some investigation into the accusations leveled against Ted Haggard. And what he did say to me is that he knows that there has been some admission of indiscretion, but not an admission to all the material that has been discussed. He also went on to say that he said that there is an admission of some guilt.
Well, David, that comment from the interim pastor seems like quite a bombshell, especially given that Reverend Haggard has been denying everything.
Well, certainly. This does, you know, open it up to wondering what exactly that means and what he's exactly admitting to.
Well, let's back up a little bit for those just joining us. First of all, tell us a little bit more about Reverend Haggard. How big a figure is he in the evangelical movement?
Well, he's very far up there. We're in Colorado Springs, and we have a number of evangelical organizations down here, Focus on the Family being the other one. And both of those organizations are known throughout the country, if not the world, for their role in being evangelical frontmen for the community.
Well, we understand he's even part of a weekly phone call with President Bush.
He has been known to have conversations with President Bush from time to time, for sure.
And he has actually been focused most recently on the fight against gay marriage and constitutional amendments. He said earlier today, in fact, that he thinks that's what this allegation is about, you know, trying to, you know, take the focus off of that issue. How much has he been working on that issue?
Well, it's something that he has come out in support of. We here in Colorado, voters are going to be looking at a particular amendment that would be a definition of men and woman marriage in Colorado. And Reverend Haggard has come out in support of the protection amendment here in Colorado. Now, there's also another one, a referendum that's coming up that would grant some legal rights to same-sex couples. He has said that is one that he has not expressed any interest in. On the other hand, though, he has actually come out and been outspoken for the protection of marriage as something that he stands for in his position as Reverend here at New Life Church.
On the other hand, we also understand that Reverend Haggard has been trying to broaden the evangelical agenda. He believes in global warming, for instance, and has said that should be an evangelical priority, something some Christian leaders are beginning to do. So he's not exactly lockstep.
Not exactly. No, he comes across and on a number of issues that wouldn't necessarily kind of put him in the same category as some others, for sure. He has a number of thoughts on these issues, like you say, that may set him apart somewhat.
And what about his accuser, Mike Jones, a former prostitute? We understand that your colleagues at KUSA-TV reported that a voice analysis expert compared a voicemail recording provided by Jones to one of Haggard's speech and says that they match. But we also understand that Mr. Jones went on a radio program in Colorado today and took a polygraph test, which he failed. Jones said he hadn't had much sleep. He had a migraine when he took the test. He's looking a little worse for wear. How are people in Colorado Springs responding to Mike Jones and his accusations?
If you're talking specifically about folks who attend church at New Life Church, it's a tough day for them, but one that the local community of New Life Church are trying to cope with the best they can.
It's also been a fast-moving day for reporters. So, David, I just want to ask you, you may not have the answer yet, but and we certainly don't know the truth yet. Reverend Haggard has denied the accusations that he had a relationship with a male prostitute, but still he is the leading voice against things like gay marriage. And I'm wondering if you have any sense of how this might reverberate on Election Day, especially in the wake of the Mark Foley Page scandal and the sense of critics that Republicans are, you know, demonizing the gay lifestyle on the one hand while secretly participating in it on the other.
I know that there are a lot of folks who have probably made up their minds already on where they stand on these different amendments, and I don't necessarily know how cutting of an issue this will be come Tuesday.
Perhaps just providing some sadness on Sunday.
Right.
At the megachurch.
Right.
David, thank you so much.
I appreciate your time.
David Nancaro, a reporter and anchor for KKTV in Colorado Springs. And this note, next week on Here and Now, GOTV. They don't even have time to say the whole sentence. Get out the vote. We'll look at the machines that both parties will have up and running at full speed ahead of Tuesday's election. GOTV. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes
now. There's a dire warning today from a team of researchers studying the world's oceans. The group says the world could run out of seafood by 2048. The report, published in the journal Science, concludes that overfishing, pollution, and other environmental factors are to blame. The National Marine Fisheries Service acknowledges there are problems, but says the projection is too pessimistic. Well, we want to take a closer look at the report. We turn first to David Helvarg, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. David, first of all, your reaction when you read this report?
Well, it's disturbing, but unfortunately not unpredicted. There's been similar reports. Boris Wurm, who's the lead author on this one, worked with Rand Meyer several years ago on a report that says we've lost 90% of our large pelagic predators, our sharks and groupers and similar fish, to industrial overfishing.
And why is that important, by the way, when you lose the large fish?
They're the keystones. They're the indicators. And the result is, as we take the big fish out, we just begin fishing down the food chain until we're, you know, the warning is we end up with plankton soup.
It's not just fishing, though. I mean, we've done several reports here on plastics and antibiotics and bacteria floating around in the sea, sort of migrating.
Obviously, it's the cumulative impacts when we, on the one hand, look to the sea as a source of protein and recreation and trade, and on the other hand, treat it as a garbage can. Certainly, the scale of fishing just in my lifetime in the last 50 years has skyrocketed from about 20 million metric tons per year to some 100 million by the late 1980s. I was out on an aircraft carrier when I was working on my book, and you know, you're up there on the bridge watching the catapults and 4.5 acre flight deck, and it's amazing the scale. And then you realize that every year we take the equivalent of 900 aircraft carriers and living biomass out of the ocean. And the result is we're simply taking fish out faster than they can reproduce.
You're talking about these huge nets and these huge operations that trawl the seas.
Huge and industrial trawlers and operations, deep sea trawling in the open oceans, and a lot of coastal fleets that are overcapitalized. Governments actually like China, like Turkey, like the EU, that subsidize fishing power. So the fleets become overcapitalized. We put too many nets in the water. This was a problem in this country that we're still having to deal with, even though the subsidies and the tax incentives ended back in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. The fact is we've inherited military technologies from the Navy, like sonar and satellite tracking of fish aggregations, and we've taken it to the point where we're fishing for a global seafood market that will take pretty much anything indigenous to the ocean.
Well, and as you know, the National Marine Fisheries Service has weighed in on this. They're quoted in today's Boston Globe saying, first of all, they think that the report is too dire and that humans can reverse this trend.
Well, we certainly can reverse the trend, and that's, I think, the hope of the study. The study is based on data available through 2003 and data from sources like the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization that tracked the landings. We certainly see local examples of successes bringing back the striped bass off the East Coast. On the other hand, the more typical model is what happened in New England, when for years scientists warned the Fishing Council that we're overfishing cod, and the warnings went ignored until the cod fishery collapsed after 500 years. We had massive closures in 1994.
But quick question, how do you save the fish without killing the fishing industry, which you speak of the huge trawlers, but it's also composed of, you know, people running their small boats out of Gloucester, Massachusetts, right here. And, you know, how do you not kill them off?
I call it a blue plate special, buybacks, where if you've overcapitalized the fleet, you take it down by buying back so people are have an option. They don't lose their livelihood entirely, and those mm-hmm. who remain in the fishery can continue to fish in a sustainable manner. Limited entry. You simply don't allow the taking of fish at a faster rate than they can reproduce. Underwater reserves, up to 20% of the ocean, should be no-take zones. And finally, enforcement. You know, on a global level, we need the Coast Guard and other enforcers to go out there and enforce our rules and regulations, our bilateral agreements, our international treaties to protect these resources for the long term. And I think this dire warning is really hopeful. We know what the solutions are, but we have to act on them.
David Helvarg, president of the Blue Frontier Campaign, author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas, on today's report in the journal Science that the fish in those seas might disappear by the year 2048. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And we turn now to Vito Colombo, executive director of the Massachusetts Fisheries Recovery Commission and a third-generation fisherman from Gloucester, Mass. Vito, what do you think about the prediction, no fish by 2048?
I think it's far too dire. I think that right now we have the largest biomass of small pelagics, such as mackerels and herons, we've ever seen in probably my history, and I started fishing around 1958. They predicted this probably 1.5 million metric tons of mackerel fishing in the North Atlantic, probably around 2 million metric tons of heron fishing in the North Atlantic. Striped bass is fully recovered beyond my 50 years of fishing, and I'm a third-generation fisherman, so there's more than overfishing occurring as I see it.
Well, but you do, I'm sure, recognize that there are problems, and these researchers tracked 1,000 years of change, 12 coastal areas. They looked at the catch records for 64 regions for the last 53 years. Do you acknowledge that there are some problems?
Yes, there are major problems. I look at pollution as one of the major problems. We've filled in landfills and marshes and estuaries. Mm-hmm. We've built on top of them. We've destroyed breeding ground. That's fish habitat. Not the fishermen, but we the people, and that includes fishermen, I guess, but not directly fishing. We the people have destroyed. We've used the ocean as a cesspool. We've dumped toxic waste in there. We've dumped effluents from people. We've spilled oil into our oceans. Yet everybody points the finger at the fishermen.
Yeah, you think the fishermen are taking the rap for what the population in general has done to the oceans? Well, the researchers do point out that pollution and other environmental factors are part of this idea of wiping out species. David Helvarg says this is reversible. What else do you think needs to be done?
If we continue the way we're going and if we keep polluting, I agree that we could probably catch the last fish, but no fisherman wants to catch the last sacred cod, especially in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We need to work with the fishermen hand in hand. Maybe there are times that we should not allow fishing if some of the stocks are down and we need to recover them. But we also should bring from the government some monies to help these people out. We're destroying not only the fishing industry through pollution, we're destroying the fishing communities, a way of life that I've been brought up with. You know, Gloucester's the oldest fishing port in the country, and it's just about destroyed. Where there was 100 large vessels, we're down to 8. Where there was 250 to 300 vessels, we're down to about 100. So, you know, I can't see that we keep pointing the same thing over and over, fishing, fishing, fishing. I think it's destruction of habitat by we, the humans.
Vito Colombo, executive director of the Massachusetts Fisheries Recovery Commission. Vito, thanks as always for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Well, still to come today, the 68th anniversary of the day most Americans first heard Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. We have that live broadcast, Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra. Just exquisite. You're listening to Here and Now. The shadow of Barbaro hangs over tomorrow's Breeders' Cup at Churchill Downs. Barbaro, of course, won the Kentucky Derby, but then suffered that awful hind leg injury in the Preakness and nearly died. Bernardini went on to win the Preakness and is now the favorite in the $5 million Breeders' Cup Classic tomorrow afternoon. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. He joins us from Louisville. And Joe, we've spoken to you before, and I know you feel this in your heart as well as, you know, in your work every day. It's so sad that, well, first of all, it could have been a great race to see these two horses racing against each other tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely, Robin. We probably were cheated out by injury and the fates, nobody's fault, of something along the lines of Alidar, Easy Goer, or Affirmed Alidar,
yeah.
And, you know, a great rivalry, and it's really crushing now when you think in that 15 seconds, we have a photograph we're running tomorrow where Bernardini and Barbaro are next to each other for 15 seconds in the Preakness. And, you know, this could have been the rubber match if Barbaro wouldn't have broken down.
Well, and a more important issue, though, is that he did, and just for people who love animals, I could care less about, you know, the race. How is Barbaro doing?
Barbaro is recovering as well. He's beyond expectations, Robin. I mean, what we have to stress is this is going to take months and months and months. The hind leg seems to be doing well, healing properly. The real worry always was laminitis, which is a condition that eats at the hoof wall.
Mm.
And it comes from bearing weight, excessive weight on the opposite limb. And he got that, and it's usually fatal. It's often fatal, especially with an injury like this. But he came back, and it's growing back slowly but surely, and that's what has to happen.
Well, that is good news, and takes us back to Bernardini, the horse that did win and is running. You had a fascinating story earlier this week about Bernardini's owner. Now, he's actually the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. They call him, I guess, Sheikh Mo at the track. Who is this man?
Sheikh Mo, he is the ruler of Dubai. Dubai is one of the fastest growing and, I guess, westernized Middle Eastern countries at this point. They got in the news recently for trying to buy the ports, and, you know, six of them were in the U.S., and Washington wouldn't stand for that. But here's a guy who, for 25 years, has been coming to Kentucky and literally spending billions of dollars on horse flesh.
Billions of dollars. I mean, I understand he has 160 employees, all of them Kentuckians.
Yeah, and that's just in Kentucky, Robbie. He has six other operations from Australia, Japan, Ireland, England. This guy has just spent buku's money trying to breed horses and racing horses. And, you know, it's a twofold thing. There's a method to his madness. It isn't a loss leader. I mean, yes, he has more money than most horse owners, than most professional franchise owners, to most people in the world. But at the same time, he has paralleled this with his vision for Dubai as this tourist mecca, this business center, and he has used sports and horses to build his whole country, and now they get 5 million tourists a year. Tiger Woods played golf there. They have a PGA event.
But has he been good for horse racing here?
Yeah, you know, absolutely, it is true he has, because he can be more patient with a horse. I mean, he would have done like the Jacksons did if it was Bernardini and not Barbaro. He had the financial wherewithal to make sure Barbaro got the best care. And he handles his horses. Bernardini won the Preakness and skipped the Belmont, which is unheard of. He could have had two-thirds of the Triple Crown. But he had run four times within the last 2 months. They thought it was going to be too much on him. They looked ahead to like days like today, or tomorrow, actually.
And held him back.
Yeah, and held him back. And, you know, I've seen his stables down here, and from what I hear from Dubai, I mean, his horses live better than you and I, Robin. And I can vouch for that firsthand.
Well, I don't know about you, Joe, but as to me, that's not hard on a Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Drape, just real quick, you have a couple seconds. Is your money on Bernardini?
You know, actually, I'm going to take Sheikh Mo's brother's horse, Hamden's
okay.
horse, Invasor, who's won 8 of 9, who is another well-bred. He was the Uruguayan Triple Crown champion, and I'm a contrarian. And
all right. Well, people listen to you. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. Also the author of Black Maestro, the epic life of the American legend Jimmy Wingfield, the last black jockey to ride a Kentucky Derby winner. Terrific if we want to get that in. Joe's in Louisville for tomorrow's Breeder Cup at Churchill Downs. Joe, we'll see how you did. Thanks.
Have a good weekend, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. here and now. At 10 p.m. on the 5th of November, 1938, Arturo Toscanini took baton in hand to conduct the NBC Symphony Orchestra in Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. It was the first time the Adagio was presented to a national audience. It soon became a national treasure. This year, Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings was added to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry as music deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Well, we want to mark the first performance of the Adagio for Strings, and who else to talk to but Barbara Heyman? She's the author of Samuel Barber, the Composer and His Music, and she joins us from New York. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you. Hello, Robin.
Why was this performance such a milestone, a groundbreaking event, not just for Barber, a young man then, but for Toscanini?
Well, Toscanini was known for his avoidance of performing contemporary music, certainly until the early 40s, and he had all but completely ignored American composers. It was, of course, important for Barber because it brought his music to national attention, and not only nationally, but internationally as well.
But because he was a very young man, and we understand that when he first wrote his Adagio for Strings, the second movement of his string quartet in B minor, Barber thought he was onto something. He called it a knockout.
Yes, he wrote to his friend Orlando Cole, who is the cellist of the Curtis String Quartet, "I just finished the second movement of my string quartet, and it's a knockout." To have that kind of prescience about a work that would become one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century and beyond, I think, is really extraordinary.
But to get Toscanini to play it was another matter. I mean, we've read that, the idea that Toscanini would perform something would mean that God had deemed it,
yes,
to have
exactly.
enough merit. You know.
Exactly. His broadcasts were regarded with nearly religious reverence, There's a wonderful story about how ultimately he gave Barber his decision. Barber gave him two works in January of 1938, the Essay for Orchestra and the Adagio for Strings, which was an arrangement of the second movement of his first and only string quartet. So Toscanini returned both scores to Barber without comment and then sailed for Europe. Barber had intended to visit the conductor at his home in Italy that summer, but he was so annoyed by Toscanini's lack of response to his works that he sent Menotti on without him.
Giancarlo Menotti,
who was Barber's friend. Anyway, Toscanini said, according to Menotti, "Where's your friend Barber?" And Giancarlo said, "Well, he's not feeling very well." Toscanini, "I don't believe that. He's mad at me. Tell him not to be mad. I'm not going to play one of his pieces. I'm going to play both." What Barber did not know was that Toscanini had memorized both scores before he returned them to Barber.
And then also, it became a bit of a scuffle in the New York Times letters to the editor and editorial pages, because this was at a time when people were deciding what modern American music was, and they thought maybe Adagio for Strings was a little too conservative compared to some of the other music. But how did people react? I mean, after they heard it that night, what were Americans saying?
The piece was considered one of the great masterpieces. It did become, as it were, our national funeral music, because it was played on the radio directly following the announcement of President Roosevelt's death.
And then also after the death of Albert Einstein. And I remember after the death of John F. Kennedy, I've spoken of that here.
Oh, yes.
It was just an extraordinary. I remember as a child just thinking it was the most beautiful moment I'd ever seen on a television. It went on to be used in Oliver Stone's film Platoon. Also with great effect. Let's talk a little bit about why that happens. What is it about this piece musically that does that?
It is kind of mystifying to some extent, because some people would think, did Barber write it with death on his mind, and that is not the case at all. It was written the summer of 1936 when he was living with Giancarlo in a game warden's cottage in the Tyrolean Alps in St. Wolfgang.
Yeah, which sounds like an idyllic time. I mean,
was idyllic, and he wrote home to his uncle Sidney Homer, who was a composer and Barber's beloved mentor for more than 25 years. He wrote, "This is perfection. This is wonderful."
There's one musical moment in Adagio I just want to ask you about. It's when the violin notes are sustained for the longest time at the highest note before they tumble down.
In other words, it reaches a climax, is what you're saying.
Before they tumble down again,
yes,
down the scale.
Yes.
It's such a piercing sound. I'm sure you've analyzed it. Was there, what was it about that moment?
Well, I think it's everything that led up to that moment that makes that moment so exciting. As William Schumann, a contemporary of Barber's, said when asked why it works so well, it's because it's so precise emotionally. The emotional climate is never left in doubt. It begins, it reaches its climax, it makes its point, and then it dies away.
And we now know he might have been writing about just the exquisite nature of an extraordinary day. It's just something so exquisite that it came to that point. Virgil Thomson, the composer, told a BBC interviewer he thought of the Adagio as a love scene, a detailed love scene, not a dramatic one, but a very successful one. And he also spoke of that climax near the end. Let's listen to a bit of that incredible section.
Okay.
Wow. I mean, every time...
And then silence. You know, someone once said that the serenity of this piece suggests tranquility and grief. And maybe that's why people associate it with mourning or pain, you know. But as I've said, it could just as easily be on a list of the 10 best pieces to make love by. Perhaps at this moment of technological advance, where we can communicate so instantly across the globe, and there's a kind of climate of depersonalization, devoid of emotional nuance, and perhaps that's why music that is unabashedly romantic, that elicits a direct emotional response, is more valued.
Unabashed. Unabashed. That's the perfect word.
Unabashedly romantic, yes.
That's so perfect. Barbara Heyman, author of Samuel Barber, the Composer and His Music. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Robin.
And thanks also to Alan Lisitsky for his copy of the 1938 recording of the Adagio. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join